Hello and welcome to Fantastic Fights, the podcast about a middle-aged man playing adventure game books out loud on the internet. That middle-aged man is me, Hieronymus J. Doom, and this episode we're beginning a series I've been looking forward to since I started this podcast way back in the distant mists of the past. We are playing Steve Jackson's Sorcery Book 1, The Shamatanti Hills, a classic offshoot of Fighting Fantasy with a title designed specifically to mess with my dyslexic brain. Before we get into that, I need to thank a patron who has increased their pledge. Simone, thank you so much. Your support helps make this show possible and has led to me restarting my other podcast, Popular Antiquarian, where I'm currently watching a mockbuster a week until my brain starts to melt. I've also started work on my next game book with the goal of not leaving it until the last minute this year, which is what happened last year, and I kind of had to work through Christmas, and it was a bit silly. There's lots of fun stuff coming down the pipe, and it's all thanks to kind souls going to patreon.com/HJDoom and pledging as little as a quid to keep the nonsense coming. It also helps keep the shows ad-free. Sorcery is a series of four game books with a linked plot that gets steadily more and more ambitious as the story progresses. They were all written by Fighting Fantasy co-creator Steve Jackson and were intended to be a little bit more grown up in their approach to the medium. Across the four books, you take on the role of a brave adventurer searching for the fabled Crown of Kings in order to save your homeland of Annaland from invasion. All four books have art by legendary British illustrator John Blanche, and a slightly more in-depth magic system is available, which we'll talk about in a moment. John Blanche is best known for his work with Games Workshop, and his intricate, gothic and grotesque artwork has probably had a bigger influence on the UK gaming scene in general than any other artist I can think of. He is a personal favourite, and I'm really looking forward to enjoying his work throughout this series. I've got the Wizard Books reissue of The Shamatanti Hills, which sadly lacks the original John Blanche cover. The cover art here is by Mel Grant, and like the original, it shows a manticore doing manticore stuff. It's a solid bit of work, honestly, with the beast looking appropriately ferocious and armed with a set of teeth so gnarly and sharp that I genuinely don't think it could close its mouth even if it wanted to, which it clearly doesn't. There's a big pile of skulls in the background and also a half-eaten corpse, so even though I inevitably prefer John Blanche's more characterful illustration, this is still a very solid bit of work indeed. Let's take a look at the rules. We've got skill, stamina and luck all present and correct, and that's nice. We get a choice whether we want to play as a warrior who rolls their skill as normal, or if you're the kind of genius who's ready for the advanced rules, you can choose to play as a wizard, in which case you roll 1d6 and add 4 when generating your skill. I'm clearly a very clever person, so I'm going to play using the advanced rules. The advanced rules, which are really just the magic rules, are neat because they find a fun way to model the classic fantasy trope of wizards needing to memorise their spells. There's a whopping list of 48 spells, and each of them has a 3-letter name associated with them. Once the game starts, you're not allowed to actually look at the spellbook, so you need to try to remember what all the different spells do based on their 3-letter names. Some of them have material components as well that you will need to cast them, adding another layer of memory challenge to proceedings. All spells cost you variable amounts of stamina, which is one of my favourite ways of representing and limiting a spellcrafter's power, not least because it adds additional jeopardy by making you more vulnerable to sudden death the more spells you cast. Some of the spells have nice simple names that sum up their effects really efficiently. I'm not going to go through the full list, but the spell Zap, Z-A-P, creates a lightning bolt at a cost of 4 stamina, and the spell Hot will let you chuck a fireball for the same cost. In general, the simpler and more obviously useful the spell is, the higher the stamina cost will be. So Foff, F-O-F, which summons a force field, costs 4 stamina, but Jig, which makes a target want to bust out their best dance moves, costs only 1 stamina, though it does also require a flute. This spell system looks like so much fun, and I'm looking forward to getting slightly better at remembering what all the spells do as we progress through the series. As well as spells, we can also once per book call upon the aid of our patron deity Libra, Goddess of Justice. There's three different options available for doing that. She very much operates a set menu for how you want to be aided in your quest. The first option simply allows you to return all your stats to their initial level, which sounds extremely handy, honestly. You can also call on her aid to cure diseases and curses if you happen to be so afflicted. And lastly, you can sometimes, when specified in the text, call on her help to escape from a fight or other tricky situation. All of these seem variously useful, but I particularly like being able to reset your stats when you've made it deep into the book, so you can keep playing for just that little bit longer. That's really cool. In terms of gear, we've got the obligatory sword and backpack, a modest 20 gold coins for sundry expenses, and a paltry 2 meals for stuffing into our face. Unusually, this book states that you can only eat a meal when instructed by the text, and you restore whatever stamina the text tells you to restore when you eat your one and only meal. So, no cramming down 4 roast dinners in a row to deal with a broken leg in this book, it would seem. I have rolled up a character I have decided to call Flamenco Opsec, because that sounds like a suitably heroic name. They have a paltry skill of 5, thanks to their being a wizard, a stamina of 19, and a luck of 12. They sort of remember some of the more obvious spells, which is handy given the state of their skill. With all those preliminaries out of the way, let's play the Shamatanti Hills. The Legend of the Crown of Kings. Centuries ago, in the time we now call the Dark Ages, whole regions of the world were undiscovered. There were pockets of civilization, each with their own race and culture. One such region was Kakhbad, a dark land at the ends of the earth. Although several warlords had tried, Kakhbad had never been ruled. All manner of evil creatures, forced from the more civilized lands beyond the Zanzunu Peaks, had gradually crawled into Kakhbad, which became known as the Vermin Pit at Earth End. Very much Titan's answer to Milton Keynes, apparently. All truly diabolical and evil things in our world gradually make their way to Milton Keynes, drawn by the siren call of that many roundabouts. Civilization and order had spread throughout the rest of the known world ever since the discovery of the Crown of Kings by Chelana, the reformer of Femfri. With its help, Chelana became emperor of the largest empire in the Eastern world. This magical crown had mysterious powers, bestowing supernormal qualities of leadership and justice on its owner. But Chelana's own ambitions were not of conquest. He wished instead to establish peaceful nation-states aligned with Femfri. Thus, in his wisdom, he passed the fabled crown from ruler to ruler in the neighbouring kingdoms, and with the help of its magical power, one by one, those lands became peaceful and prosperous. The path was set. Each ruler would own the Crown of Kings for a 4-year period in which to establish order within his kingdom and fall in with the growing Femfri alliance. So far, the kingdoms of Ruddlestone, oh, well, remember that, Lendelland, Galantaria, and Bryce had taken their turns under the rule of the crown. The benefits were immediate. War and strife were virtually unknown. Seems like a handy, handy thing. Feel as though if the Crown of Kings were discovered in our world, it would be melted down for scrap within moments. Politicians lining up to say that they didn't subscribe to letting some mystical hat tell them what to do, even though the mystical hat is right about everything. The King of Annaland duly received the Crown of Kings amid great ceremony, and from that day onwards, the development of Annaland was ensured. No one quite knew how the Crown of Kings could have such an enormous uplifting effect on a whole nation. Did it have an amusing slogan on it, like, "I'm with stupid" or something? Some said it was divinely inspired, some that its power was merely in the mind. But one thing was certain, its effects were unquestionable. All was well in Annaland until the night of the Black Moon. The king was the first to discover that the crown was missing. Carried off on that starless night by birdmen from Zaman, the crown was on its way to Mampang in the outlaw territories of Cacbad. News came from the backlands that the crown was being carried to the Archmage of Mampang, whose ambitions were to make Cacbad his kingdom. Although Cacbad was a dangerous land, it was in itself little threat to the surrounding kingdoms. The lack of rule meant it had no army, and its own internal struggles kept it permanently preoccupied. But with the crown of kings to establish rule, Cacbad could be potentially a deadly enemy to all members of the Femfrey Alliance. Such was the shame that fell on Annaland for the loss of the crown, that all benefits from 2 years under its rule soon disappeared. Law, order and morale were breaking down. The king was losing the confidence of his subjects. Neighbouring territories were looking suspiciously across their borders. There were even whisperings of invasions. Only one hope remained. Someone, for a military force would never survive the journey, must travel to Mampang and rescue the crown of kings. Only on its safe return would the dreadful curse be lifted from Annaland. You have volunteered yourself for this quest, and your mission is clear. You must cross Cacbad to the Mampang fortress and find the crown. So that is our opening. Fine, I would say. The sort of thing we've seen many, many times before with a mysterious evil doer in the distance, having done a bad thing in order to try and conquer the world, and a lone adventurer being sent to stop them. It's fine, it's nicely written. And it did a surprisingly good job, I thought, of selling the idea that we're at this strangely pivotal moment in the history of this fantasy land whereby maybe, just maybe, everything could be fine if we can regain this crown and get back on the right timeline. So, it feels as though the stakes are higher than just our kingdom. This bold attempt to create a Femfrey Alliance seems to be hanging on it as well. I do like that. There's a nice map of the area of Cacbad, showing Kare, the city port of Traps, which we'll be going to next time. The Shamantanti Hills, which is our first port of call. Then the Backlands, the Vantibak Wastes, the Clatterback Steppes, Lozarman, Highzarman, the Forest of Snatter, and far off in the northeast is Mampang Fortress. So, always exciting to see where we're going to go. You awake at sunrise. After dressing, you breakfast on bread and goat's milk and collect your belongings. Outside, the outpost settlement is stirring. The womenfolk emerge to wash and prepare their meals as the day's guard takes over. Eyes follow you as you leave your hut and walk towards the Shamantanti wall. The frontiers people are well aware of your mission, and a small crowd of well-wishers follows some distance behind you. Before you stands the Kantapani Gate, guarded constantly by Sightmaster warriors chosen for their powers of telescopic vision. The gate is the final doorway between Annaland and Cacbad. Once more, you check your pack. Satisfied that your preparations are complete, you nod to the Sightmaster Sergeant. For the last time, he glances at the lookout atop the gate who signals the all clear. The sergeant orders the bolt to be withdrawn. A doorway opens up in front of you, and you get your first view of the Shamantanti foothills, the first stage of your journey. The Sightmaster Sergeant strides over and grasps your hand. "I will not wish you safe journey, for the way ahead will not be safe. Cacbad is a treacherous land inhabited by devils. But this you already know. Take the path ahead to Cantapani, a small settlement of traders, although most are rogues and thieves. You should reach there within the hour. From Cantapani onwards, there are three routes through Biratanti to Karai, a city port on the Jabaji River. God, this is really a workout for my ability to pronounce made-up words. From Karai, you must cross the backlands, which are unknown. It is said that day and night in the backlands are not controlled by the sun, but by supernatural forces. And bear in mind, also, that from Kahara your progress will be watched. His warnings do little to inspire confidence in you. He continues, but I have observed your training, and you are indeed a worthy champion. I wish you luck and success with your quest. My thoughts and the good wishes of all the people of Annaland will be with you. With Libra on your side, you may live to lift the curse and the depression which racks our kingdom. You shake his hand, thank him for his good wishes, and step up to the gate. Resolutely, you pass through the doorway. The faces of the folk watching your departure reveal the hopes that rest with you and the success of your quest. With a wave, you turn and face the hills. The early morning air is crisp, and the rising sun paints the hills in colours of natural beauty which conceal the devilry ahead. Setting off determinedly, you follow the path your quest has begun. There is a nice picture of the Sightmaster Sergeant, who's got a very big, impressive stick with a sort of hat and a plume on the end. He's wearing a horned helmet of genuinely ludicrous design and some sort of fur-trimmed jerkin, over which there's some scale mail. It's just fabulous. He looks like an absolute lunatic. Real sense of someone who's gone to a cosplay competition in the throes of a break with reality. Yeah, really like it. The path winds through fields of wild scrubland. The countryside is deserted, and an eerie silence is broken only by the cawing of an occasional crow. The birds appear to pause in the air to examine you as they pass, and you feel uneasy in their presence. You pass over a small hillock, from the top of which you can see the path continuing downwards into a small settlement of huts at the base of the Shamatanti Hills. You follow the path, and as you approach the village, noises and movements indicate that it is populated. As the path runs straight through the village, you have little choice but to follow it. The round huts are made of a hard-baked bright clay with thatched roofs. As you pass, eyes appear at dark doorways watching your movements. Suddenly, a villager appears from one of the dwellings and stands before you. He is 5 feet tall, with thick-set arms and thighs half-clothed in tattered breeches. His eyes are wild, and his long red hair and beard stand out on his face in a wiry tangle. "Halt, stranger," he commands. "What business have you in Cantapani?" What is your response? So we can tell him that we are a trader, which is a lie. We can ask for directions onwards, or we can tell him that we are hungry and need provisions. Let's go for being hungry and needing provisions. We've got some provisions, but not very many. He motions on ahead, telling you that you will find the village inn shortly on the right. By choosing this option, you will now discover one of the rules of the game, which you would otherwise only discover by trial and error. The adventure is divided into days, and each day you will need to eat one meal, otherwise you will lose stamina points due to undernourishment. Options will be given either to eat provisions from your pack or to buy food at local inns during the day. When you go for a day without food, you will suffer. When night comes, you will be given the option to sleep or continue through the night. Likewise, if you miss a night's sleep, you will also lose stamina points as you will be tired the next day, although taking a night's rest will usually replenish your stamina. But you will have to choose your times to eat and sleep carefully, as sometimes a seemingly safe place to rest and eat may hold hidden dangers. You walk on ahead as the villager indicated. So, it's kind of stuff that probably should have been in the rules section if you're going to make it this explicit. I'm not a fan, it turns out, of doing this kind of thing in the text of the book. Honestly, these feel like the kind of rules that would be better discovered through trial and error anyway. Anyway, we are walking on. The inn offers hot meals for sale, and if you wish to stop and eat, the charge will be 1 gold piece. Bread and goat's cheese are available if you want to buy food to take with you, and the price of 2 meals worth is 2 gold pieces. Do you want to sit down and eat, or do you want to buy provisions? Or do you want to continue with or without new provisions? I think I will sit down and eat, because I want to find some rumours, if at all possible, as well. The meal is warm and nourishing. Add 2 stamina points. Well, my stamina is maximum, so that doesn't help. My gold, however, is now 19. You continue along the path, leaving the village behind. About 30 minutes later, you reach the start of the climb into the hills and continue upwards. 5 minutes later, you reach a fork offering you 2 ways onwards. Bit disappointing not to meet any ne'er-do-wells in the pub. I mean, that is a real classic bit of fantasy nonsense that I genuinely always find compelling. I guess I should just be grateful we didn't go to a market. Anyway, onwards, there's a fork offering 2 ways, which could clearly have been listed in this section. You ponder the 2 trails. As you consider the path onwards, you hear weak cries from the large tree ahead of you. Cautiously, you step up to see an old man sitting on the lowest branch, apparently afraid to jump down to the ground, which, considering his age, is not surprising. Yes, first old man, early doors, that's nice to see. There is a picture of the old man in the tree. He looks properly gnarled and a bit diseased, and, I mean, it's really good. I don't know what I expected. It's John Blanche. He looks weird. He looks really good. I like it a lot. He pleads with you to assist, and you help him down. It transpires that he has been travelling from Dumpus and is headed towards the outpost settlement in Annaland. His journey had been safe enough until he was waylaid by elvins, robbed and left in the tree. That's a mean trick. I mean, you've already taken his stuff. Why have you chucked him into a tree? In return for your kindness, he relates a rhyme which he feels may help you. See him though he sees you not, the black-eyed creature creeps. A guardian once, but now his lot, the key to freedom keeps. He is not sure exactly what the rhyme signifies, but he knows that the elvins are particularly keen on finding the key in question. He also presses on you his only possession, a page from a spellbook, page number 102. Oh look, we found our first item with a number stamped on it. The spell described is incomplete, you have only part of it. Looking at it, it appears to be some sort of pest-repelling spell. He then bids you farewell and heads off towards Cantapani. You may now choose your way onwards. Will you take the highway up into the hills, or the low way along the valley? Alternatively, you may investigate a buzzing coming from around the tree. I'm going to investigate the buzzing, I think. Who doesn't love a bunch of bees? As you look up, you can see a beehive around which a small swarm of bees are buzzing. You may climb up the tree to investigate or ignore it and continue onwards. I think I might just leave the bees to it. I mean, honey's nice and all, but I'm perfectly happy letting the bees have the honey. Yeah, we'll leave them to it. The path into the valley or the high path to the hills? Well, the book is called The Shamatanti Hills, not the Shamatanti Valley, so we're going to go up into the hills. I guess hills also inevitably indicate the presence of valleys, if there's more than one hill. The path winds upwards into the hills and you enter a wood. The afternoon sun glints through the trees, playing tricks on your eyes. Every so often you catch a glimpse of some strange-shaped animal or other watching you, only to find out that it is the silhouetted branches and leaves caught at an odd angle. You reach a position where you may rest and eat provisions if you wish. I do not wish, because I have already scoffed a big meal today. The climb continues for 2 or 3 hours as the path twists this way and that up the hillside. Soon the air gets cold and the sun sets, making it difficult for you to see. However, The moon is full and will be able to light the way as it gets darker. Would you like to continue further marching through the night, or will you stop and make camp to get some sleep? Well, I know for a fact I'm completely useless unless I get something around 8 hours at a minimum when it comes to sleep. So I'm going to stop and make camp. I don't see any particular mileage in pressing on through the night. You settle down to make camp for the night. You may take provisions here, and if you do so, you may add 2 stamina points if you have not yet eaten since leaving Annaland, or 1 stamina point if you've already eaten on your journey. You may only eat if you have provisions with you. As you curl up in your blanket to sleep, there is a chance that you may encounter a wandering night creature. Remember this reference as you will return here afterwards. And turn to 1, 2, 3. Night creatures are less likely to approach you in your camp, so you may add 2 points to the die roll you are required to make. Let's have a look at the wandering monster table. Who doesn't love a wandering monster table? So we've got a giant bat, a wolfhound, a werewolf, or no encounter. You must fight any creature you encounter. So let us roll a d6 and see what we get. 6. So no encounter at all. That's exciting. So after your night's sleep, you may add either 2 stamina points if you encountered no night creatures, or 1 stamina point if your sleep was disturbed. Then you set off along the trail. Quite like a wandering monster table. I think I really like a wandering monster table as it's being deployed here, because it kind of seems to grasp that a lot of the time fights in Fighting Fantasy are kind of just this filler thing that's designed to just gently and slowly drain your stamina. And I think making it so that there's a chance you don't encounter any monster, but you'll encounter monsters that fit the biome that you're travelling through is, yeah, it's good fun. It adds an extra little wrinkle to it. I would have felt kind of unlucky if the monsters had shown up at my campsite. Did you eat at all on the first day of your journey since you left Annaland? If not, you are feeling very hungry and must lose 3 stamina points. I did eat, thank you very much. As the second day of your journey breaks, you march through the cool morning air of the hills, having now climbed several hundred feet. You reach the brow of a hill and stop in your tracks. To your left is a clearing in which several poles are firmly planted in the ground. Atop the poles are heads, some recently fixed, some semi-decayed, human heads, goblin heads, and one or two heads of creatures you do not recognise, all with sewn-up eyes and mouths. A large X painted on a broad tree is obviously intended as a warning to venture no further. Ahead, the path forks to the right and to the left, but you cannot be sure which path you are warned not to take. That's cruel. Will you continue your climb along the right-hand path, or take the left-hand path which winds down the side of the hill? You know that someone's serious about no cold callers if there's the severed head of a door-to-door salesman on a stick in the garden. I don't know which of these options is the right one, but it is a straight left-right decision. So even though I'd quite like to carry on climbing, honestly, I'm going to take the left-hand path, because we always take the left-hand path. Down the hill we go. You follow the path carefully downwards, trying to avoid breaking branches as you go. Do you wish to stop along the way to eat provisions, or would you rather press on? I will eat provisions later. I've only got to do 1 meal a day. No sense in going nuts, and I'm still on maximum stamina. You continue along the trail, and the undergrowth around you gets thicker. Suddenly there is a cracking beneath your feet, and something gives way underfoot. You may test your luck. If you are unlucky, we get 1 option, lucky another option, but most interestingly, you can choose not to test your luck and just take the unlucky option. That is a cool mechanic. That's a really, really cool little mechanic. I like the idea of giving the player control over whether they test their luck. I am going to test my luck. I don't fancy falling in a trap. And my luck is 12, so I've got plenty of luck to play with. So pass automatically, and my luck now 11. You leap ahead just in time as a pitfall caves in beneath you. You look back to see a gaping pit which you would have fallen into. Your relief is somewhat premature, however, as you discover when you take your next step forward. Your foot triggers a release mechanism, and three saplings snap up in front of you. Each is fitted with sharpened stakes which whip towards you at heart level. You are impaled on the fiendish device, and your journey has ended here. Your head will soon join the others on the posts you have just passed. So, should have gone right, very much. Should have gone right. So, amazing that I've managed to die sort of a bit over half an hour into my recording without having actually been in a single fight. That's kind of cool. I do sort of need to work out where might be a good place to go back to, though, because it is too early. That's an incredibly cheap death. So we'll go back and we will take the right-hand path rather than the left-hand path. You press on, climbing up the hillside for several hours until you are not far from the top. And then you hear a faint sound of bustling activity. Tramping feet, grunting voices, and the clanking of metal against rock makes you stop and listen. You decide to leave the path and continue cautiously through the woods. A short distance onwards, you hide behind a tree and survey a clearing ahead. A number of goblins are in the clearing, in front of an open cave. It appears that they are mining the cave as they trudge in and out of the opening, carrying large bowls full of glistening rocks and dull metallic nuggets. From your position, you may easily slip into the cave to see whether you can find anything of value, or you may ignore the mine and slip around the side to a path leading onwards and down the far side of the hill. I think I'll leave the goblins to their mining. I can't imagine there's anything particularly useful for me in the mine, and I'm incredibly mindful of how low my skill is. I really don't want to be getting into a fight if I can possibly avoid it. You follow a path leading sharply downhill into a narrow valley. You cross a stream on a wooden bridge and start to climb the next hill. Halfway up, you hear twigs break in the undergrowth, and suddenly a large creature, about the size of a bear, stands before you. It has black and white fur and a long bushy tail which trails out behind it. The animal bars your way and is snarling menacingly at you. Will you prepare to attack it or try to edge round it peacefully? There's a picture of the beast, and it is sort of like a cross between a skunk and a bear and a cat, I would say. There's a feline cast to the creature's face. It's rearing up kind of like a bear. You can see the big bushy tail. It's unsurprisingly really good. I think I'm going to try and edge around it peacefully, which is a technique I've often been called upon to use when out walking and when I come across a swan. So I'm going to assume it's no more hostile than a swan and hope for the best. Test your luck. I roll a 6. That is lucky. Luck now 10. You manage to creep around the creature, and although it snarls menacingly, it does not attack you. You continue onwards up the path for a couple of hours, down another valley and back up another hill. It is now late afternoon, and you begin to think about where you will stay for the night. Ahead of you, however, is a small village set into the hill. That sounds like good news. I mean, so far this is mostly feeling like a walking holiday, more than a life and death struggle. But that's fine, I like a walking holiday. You walk into the village. Young hill dwellers pass you and stare at your strange clothes. Their own attire is rough by comparison, and everyone wears their hair long, but piled up on their heads. You pass without incident into the centre of the village. Will you look for an inn for the night or find an alehouse and relax? I will go to an alehouse. I'm still hoping I might come across some rumours. You find an alehouse and walk in. Gruff voices come from inside, but when you enter, The noise subsides, and the drinkers watch you suspiciously. Several hill dwellers sit around a table. And there's a picture of the hill dwellers. They are a weird and insalubrious looking lot, drinking their beer out of genuinely enormous tankards, their hair piled up on their heads and their ragged clothes. Very cartoonish, I would say, but still a lovely bit of work. It does remind me of a time I was on holiday in Yorkshire with my then girlfriend, and we went for a drink in the local pub of the village where we were staying, and when we walked in, the conversation stopped. It was like something out of an American Werewolf in London. It was the most astonishingly insular looking local pub. So nice to be reminded of that moderately scary moment in our holiday. It probably didn't help that we were both kind of wearing leather jackets and dressed very much as gothy metal types. The owner of the house tells you that you are in the village of Cristatanti and that a mug of ale will cost you 1 gold piece. If you cannot afford this price, you'll have to leave the alehouse. Otherwise, you may pay him, take your drink and sit down at the table next to an old wrinkled man or a younger man with sharp features. So I will buy a beer, I think, taking my gold down to 18. And of the two people to sit next to, I'm going to go for the old man. I love a good old man in a pub. I used to love me as well for some reason. I used to attract in pubs the weird old men. And now I am a weird old man, so the circle is complete. I guess I should go into pubs and impose myself upon youngsters and talk gibberish at them. You sit down and mutter some comments about the mud on the trails at this time of year. The old man grunts in agreement. Eventually, the silence gives way to noisy chatter once more, and you talk to the old man. He is a hill farmer on the outskirts of the village and sees much of what comes and goes in Cristatanti. He has heard of the capture of the Crown of Kings, but has little interest in world affairs. You tell him a little of yourself, and soon you are both laughing heartily as you exchange goblin jokes. Eventually he stands to leave.
"There are two ways onwards from Cristatanti, stranger," he says. "One will take you past Aliana's home, and you'll need your wits about you if she is there. The other leads up into the hills to face the Liaki, domain of the Great Ones. I wish you the luck of Sindla and your journey. Perhaps this will help you on your way."
He hands you an apple-like fruit which he has grown on his farm. It is a nourishing bomber, and if you eat this along with a normal meal, it will double your gain in stamina. You thank him and wish him good night. You may add 2 luck points for your encounter. So that's good. Luck back up to 12. I'm a lucky boy. Do you want to spend the night in the inn or wander off into the woods outside the village to sleep? I'm going to spend the night in the inn. The village inn will charge you 3 gold pieces for a night's rest and 2 gold pieces for a nourishing meal. The meal is just being served. If you wish to sit down to eat, pay the 2 gold pieces and have your bowl of skunk bear stew. I guess that's the creature we encountered on the way. That's a nice little callback. So 2 gold for the food, and we may add 3 stamina points if we eat, and gold is now 16. You will not be able to eat your own provisions at the inn, which is fair enough. If you wish to rest for the night, pay the 3 gold pieces. The bed you are given is not particularly clean, but it is comfortable. You can add 5 stamina points for a good night's rest. So I don't think I actually need to rest in their bed. My stamina is still at maximum. So we'll go and rough it outside. You creep off to the edge of the village and settle down under a tree. You may eat provisions if you wish, which will add 2 stamina points if this is your first meal of the day, or 1 stamina point if you have eaten before. You try to sleep under the tree, but you are woken continually by strange noises. Add 1 stamina point for getting some rest and leave at daybreak. Stamina still maximum. If I hadn't died that one time, this would be going superbly well. Did you eat at all yesterday? If you ate at the inn or took provisions, you suffer no penalty. But if you have not eaten during the day, you are now hungry and must lose 3 stamina points. There are two ways on from the village of Cristatanti. Choose your path from the two options below. That's annoying. We can't get any additional information because we were told to avoid one path out of the village and take the other one. That's a bit of a mean trick. We should be able to have some kind of clue that calls back to what the old man told us. You leave Cristatanti along a path which snakes out into the hills. All morning you follow it as it twists through the woods of gnarled trees until eventually you reach a clearing where another path joins from the east. A signpost at the junction indicates straight on to Dumpus and westwards to Aliana. You continue onwards or westwards. We will continue onwards because we were told to avoid Aliana like the plague. You follow the path for the rest of the afternoon until you stand on a hilltop. The path runs down the hill into a small village set on a river and you follow it down. As you follow the path downwards, you pass a sign. You are entering the village of Dumpus. Will you find an inn to rest for the night or try and make contact with the villagers? Some very odd turns of phrase in this. Try to make contact with the villagers. Yeah, that's what I'll do. But it's a slightly odd way of phrasing it. You pass along the main path through the village and stop outside a hut where several hill dwellers are sitting and eating. They are deep in discussion about something. Will you introduce yourself or ignore them and continue? I will introduce myself. They stop and look at you. They invite you over but become agitated at the sight of your weapon. You may leave your weapon and join them or thank them for their offer of hospitality and press on. With a skill of 5, I am not abandoning my sword for anything, so I will decline their offer of hospitality because I feel as though I'm asking to have my sword nicked if I just chuck it on the grass. So we will press on. Further along the way, you come across a couple of merchants' huts and browse through the items for sale. If you wish and you can afford it, you may buy any of the following items. A finely crafted sword might be helpful if you've had your sword nicked by hill dwellers. A woven skullcap. There is one spell that uses a woven skullcap, and I cannot remember what it is. And provisions for 3 meals will be 6 gold pieces. I will grab a woven skullcap, I think. Nice that this is a relatively small selection of items rather than the usual massive list. Ooh, if you've got no money, you can ask them whether they know of any work that might be going. Ooh, let's do that. One of the merchants has a friend who needs a cesspit in the backyard filling in and a fresh one digging. This will take you most of the night to do, but he will feed you and pay you. Do you want to take up this offer? Yeah, love it. Digging a cesspit? What could be nicer? God, it's like backpacking. The job is indeed unpleasant. The villager feeds you, add 2 stamina points, but you lose 3 for missing a night's sleep. We're now down to 18 stamina, but we may, if we wish, use magic to help with the job. So, there's a number of spells. There's Big, Dip, Pep, Fill, and Zap. Zap's not going to help. That's your lightning bolt. Big, I think, just literally makes you into a giant, so that might be a good option. Let's do that. Now, first spell at, well, about 50 minutes into the recording. Deduct 2 stamina points. You cast your spell and wait for it to take effect. Almost immediately, you start to expand. Your whole body begins to grow until you are almost 3 times your normal size. This allows you to finish the job quite quickly, and you manage to get half a night's sleep. Add 2 stamina points, and onwards. So I lose 2, I add 2, I stick on a stamina of 18. But yeah, I'll get some money. You finish the job well and in good time, and the villager pays you 3 gold pieces. You leave Dumpus in the early morning light. Wait, I thought I was going to be able to spend my ill-gotten gains. I want to buy a skull cap. I dug a cesspit so I could buy a skull cap. I could have bought it if I'd known. You may leave the village along one of 2 paths. One winds up into the hills if you wish to take this one. There's a number. The other takes a downhill route into a wood. We haven't been to the woods yet. Let's go to the woods. You follow a meandering path across the side of a hill for most of the morning. You may stop and eat provisions along the way if you wish, and you will gain 2 stamina points if you do. As noon approaches, you can see the path offering you 2 ways onwards. One path follows the hill downwards into a shallow valley and then climbs to the next hill. The other choice is a path which leads to a rope and wood bridge which spans the hills. Bridge sounds exciting. I'm not going to eat. Don't need to. Feel as though you're incentivised to only eat at the very end of the day to maximise potential stamina gains, which is a slightly weird thing. Illustrates how all sets of rules create slightly odd incentives to behave in particular ways. Anyway, let's cross the bridge. Love a good bridge. By the bridge is a small wooden hut. As you approach, an ugly hunchbacked creature emerges and stands between you and the bridge, barring your way. In a gruff voice, he speaks to you.
Halt, stranger, if you wish to pass. 2 answers must you give, Van Cass.
Speaks in rhyme. I already don't like him. There is a picture of Van Cass clad in rags. He's a ill-favoured-looking gentleman with a kind of, pronounced hunch and traditional ragged clothes with some nice checked patches sewn into them. Yeah, characterful. Classic John Blanche. It's really good. So, do you want to try answering his questions or retrace your steps? I'll try answering his questions. The hunchback chuckles and asks his first question.
A witch held in captivity lives in the woods. First tell to me if you know of this cunning dame. How is she known? What is her name?
And the answers are Alina, Alana or Aliana, which is a mean trick to play on his dyslexic because at least 2 of those basically look the same to me and arguably all 3 of them do. Ooh, if you don't know the name, you may test your luck, and if you're lucky, you may guess one of the names. That's really clever. It's been doing some really fun things with luck tests. And again, it's an optional luck test, which I really like. But I do remember, I think Aliana is the witch. I was sort of expecting more of a riddle and less of a local knowledge test. But I guess whatever floats the hunchback's boat. The hunchback smiles.
Your answer is correct and true. Now you must answer question 2. Through villages 3 you have now passed. What was the first, second and last?
At least his poetry broadly scans. So we went through Cantapani, Cristatanti and Dumpus. That's the right answer. I'm not going to read out the other 2 options because the made up names are really hard in this. Genuinely think that Steve Jackson just loathed dyslexics with every fibre of his being. You are correct. The hunchback stands aside to let you pass. As you start across the bridge, he wishes you well on your way. Wouldn't it be amazing if you rocked up to the toll bridge somewhere and instead of chucking some money in the pitcher, you just had to answer questions like who's the Lord Mayor of the local municipality? What local industries are particularly well represented? You march swiftly across in case he may have some other trap in store, but instead he calls out a clue which may be useful in the journey ahead. He is a sly old creature, and you must be careful to mark his words well.
Beware the lair of the cave demon's maze, for traps as deadly as Medusa's gaze. Greet travellers who, of luck bereft, take passageways not to the left.
So, traps as deadly as Medusa's gaze greet travellers who take passageways not to the left. So, go left in the cave demon's maze. Might be my imagination, but this is feeling pretty linear so far. Some way down the hill, you stop for a rest. You sit on a boulder to survey what lies ahead. The path leads downwards into a vale. Cradled between 3 hills is a village, and quite a large one at that. The sun is falling rapidly, and you decide to head downwards towards this settlement. An overhanging branch touches your face, and you hear a lively chirping. Hovering by your shoulder is a small creature the size of your thumb. It is childlike but very thin, with green skin, and it flits around you on transparent wings. It seems to be quite friendly and alights on your shoulder. You may talk to it or try and get rid of it with a spell. So the spells are six, wick, hop, gack, and wall. Of those, I remember that wall creates a wall. I think hop makes you jump. I cannot remember what six or wick or gack do. Any of those spells, I feel as though, is a little bit overkill. There's a picture of a sprite-like being, beautifully framed in the foreground with wings taking up quite a lot of it and pointing into the distance where a village appears to be between two hills. And Blanche has given it a nice kind of hazy quality that really gives a sense of perspective and distance, which I very much like. But anyway, I'm going to try and talk to the small sprite thing. I mean, I've barely got anything worth nicking, so should be fine. The creature is a mini-mite, and it calls itself Jan. It is very friendly, and tells you you are looking down on Biritanti, the largest village in the Shamatanti Hills. Biritanti is a friendly village where all travellers spend at least one night. Consequently, prices are a little on the high side. The mini-mite would like to come with you. Will you allow it to stay on your shoulder and follow the path down into Biritanti? Or will you tell it that you would rather travel alone? Oh, what's company? I think company's a good thing at this point. So we'll go with Jan into Biritanti. There seems to be a good deal of merriment in the village.
It is the festival for the young, whispers Jan. Once a year, the children are allowed the freedom of the village. It is a time of great fun and pranks.
A number of children sit in the street ahead drinking ale. A little too much, it seems, as they are laughing loudly. Ahead, a young boy holds an old woman over his knee and is spanking her. Lovely bit of kind of folklore, the world turned upside down, the inversion of traditional roles. That's all classic folk custom type stuff. A group of boys is fighting outside a hut with a sign which reads Glandragore's Tavern. A group of girls is standing at a signpost pointing to the crystal waterfall, tripping up their elders as they pass and giggling to each other. Would you like to avoid this festival and make for the inn, visit the tavern, or head for the crystal waterfall, or leave town straight away? Crystal waterfall sounds like the sort of thing that any self-respecting tourist would go and see, and I do feel as though I am much more of a tourist than a man on a desperate mission, so we'll go to the crystal waterfall. You travel along a path leading upwards a little way until you reach a large natural waterfall. The only path to it leads past a small hut where a ruffian is collecting money. It seems the price to pay for visiting this waterfall is 3 gold pieces. It is a beautiful sight with large crystal stalactites hanging from the rocks all the way down. Will you pay the price and visit the waterfall? I surely will. 3 gold I earned from digging a cesspit. They can go to this ruffian and I can go and take in the local tourist trap. The ruffian takes your 3 gold pieces and hands you a piece of cloth to use as a towel. Along with 2 other villagers, and of course Jan the Minimite, you take off your clothes and bathe in the waterfall. You begin to glow, and the cool water is not only refreshing, but also invigorating. You are bathing in a waterfall with magical healing properties. You may restore your skill, stamina, and luck to their initial values for washing away your wounds. So that very, very small amount of stamina I lost digging a cesspit has now been restored to me. The waterfall will also cure you of any diseases you may have picked up, but not curses. I'm going to say I've got scrofula just so that I can feel good about having my scrofula cured. Then you must return to the village where you pass the inn. The inn is not cheap. A bed for the night is 5 gold pieces and a meal is 4. If you eat, pay the price and add 2 stamina points, 1 if you've already eaten today. Do you want to sleep here? If not, you'd better leave the village and find a place to bed down. I will leave the village and find a place to bed down. This is daylight robbery. You find a quiet place to rest outside the village. Away from the bustle of the Festival of Youth, you are able to get a good night's sleep. The mini-mite curls up near you. You may eat provisions before you go to sleep and add 2 stamina points, or 1 if you've already eaten. So I'll eat 1 of my portions of provisions, which This being a walking holiday will be a massive slab of Kendall mint cake. Add 3 stamina points for the rest. You rise early and leave soon after dawn with Jan still hovering around your head as you set off. Did you eat at all yesterday? I did indeed. If not, you must deduct 3 stamina points. Do you want to go uphill or downhill? We'll go downhill. Why not? You travel downhill along the valley for an hour, but then the path turns uphill again. The hill you are now climbing is not too steep, and as noon approaches, you are again on a descending path. You may stop and eat provisions if you wish, and may add 2 stamina points if you do. Further along the path in the afternoon, Jan, who has been chattering incessantly to you, warns you to stop. You are being watched. As you are now in a wood, you proceed cautiously. Suddenly, the bushes part and a figure steps forward. Dressed in black, this tall man bars your way. Will you prepare to do battle or talk with him? He seems to be wearing armour, potentially, carrying a sword. There is a picture. That's a veil, a dark veil over his face. Always mysterious. He's a mysterious figure. But I will try and talk with him. I'm going to see if I can make it to the end of this recording without getting into a single fight. That, I think, genuinely would be unprecedented. The stranger ignores your words and grips a sharp scimitar. You prepare to fight the tall assassin, who has a skill of 8 and a stamina of 6. So, there are spells to be cast. Mug. Don't know what that does. Wok creates a shield. Zap creates a lightning bolt. Kill, I'm not at all sure about. I mean, presumably it doesn't just murder him. And fix, I can't remember either. Does that make him stand in place? There's one that makes people stand in place. But that needs sand anyway. I don't think I've got any. If you fight and win, that's one option. You may elect to spare his life when he's reduced to 3 stamina points, so long as you have more than 6 stamina remaining. That's really clever. I'm going to zap him. I'm going to cast zap. Deduct 4 stamina points. So stamina now 15. You cast your spell and wait for the lightning bolt to shoot at the assassin. But nothing happens. The Minimite screams at you. Don't waste your time on spells. Minimites are protected, though it is sometimes a curse with a protection aura. You cannot cast spells when I'm about. You must return to the previous section and fight the assassin. So the assassin is probably going to kill me, because he's got a skill of 8 and a stamina of 6, and I've got a skill of 5. And I know from running the battle simulator that my husband kindly wrote for me that a 3-point advantage in skill is a lot. So even with 15 stamina, this is going to be an extremely challenging affair. However, if I get lucky, I've only got to hit him twice and then I can save his life. So if I get really lucky early doors, I could come out of this all right. Anyway, we shall find out what happens, because I'm going to roll some dice. So the assassin has absolutely murdered me. I dealt 0 damage to the assassin. He just stabbed and stabbed and stabbed away at me until I died, which I did, thankfully, very quickly. So that is the end of our adventures in the Shamatanti Hills. I'm not convinced that was necessarily the greatest kind of book to be reading out loud. There's degree of repetition to it, which I don't think would have bothered me if I was just reading it, but did feel a little bit like hard work to try and inject any kind of excitement into while I was reading it out loud. But I did enjoy it, very much enjoying just how low combat this book can be. Also, what's interesting on this playthrough is little bits of it coming back to me, mostly the art. I have to say I've had sort of little Proustian rush when I saw the picture of Jan, the Minimite, and there's a couple of other ones as well that have really stirred long buried memories in me, which is interesting. I don't remember anything really about the plot or how to beat the book, but I do remember some of the pictures, so that's kind of cool. I'm really looking forward to going back and playing this on my own time, which I'm going to go and do right now. I'll be back for you in just a few seconds with some closing remarks. Tatty bye. I have finished the Shamatanti Hills, and I actually managed to beat it on my second attempt, which was quite pleasing. It's a strange one to review because on one level, there's not a lot to it. I described it as a walking holiday, and that's more or less how it feels, even by the end. There's remarkably little sense of escalation until right before the finish of the book, when you have to deal with the manticore that appears on the cover. That monster is pretty tough, but if you've remembered your spells and not done anything too stupid, you should be okay to deal with it. I'd picked up a nasty dose of the plague on my successful playthrough, and even losing 3 stamina a day to the contagion wasn't enough to stop me getting to the finish line. That character was fairly decent, but not exceptional, and I think there's a fair chance of making it even with a rubbish character, so long as you do everything right. In overall structure, you've seen pretty much everything from the recorded playthrough. You're gently meandering from settlement to settlement, getting into various scrapes and sometimes paying over the odds for food and accommodation. Everything has a strangely low-key quality to it, which seems at odds with the seriousness of the mission, but I think there's something of a method to the madness. I think there's a deliberate attempt here to create something that acts as an introduction to the dangers of Cathbad, an adventure that takes place in the liminal space between the civilization of Annaland and the true wilderness that lies beyond Kare. I think if this had been a standalone book, I'd be probably thinking it was a fairly weak entry, but knowing that there's 3 more entries and seeing several hints in the Shamatanti Hills that Steve Jackson had a solid overarching plan for the scope of the series makes it feel less disappointing and more tantalising. Still, the fact remains that there's some issues with this book, as well as some undeniable strengths. The difficulty is probably too low overall. I think it could have done with a few more compulsory fights to sell the sense of being in a land of dangers. It's something that Ian Livingstone would have done well at, I think, using some deadly wildlife to give you a sense of the environment. We've got the rather charming skunk bear in here, as well as the odd werewolf and that, on the wandering monster chart, but it never really sells the Shamatanti Hills as a coherent location with its own distinctive plants and animals. On the one hand, it's always impressive to see a fighting fantasy writer not lean on fights to pad out the encounters, but I do think they can be a useful tool for both storytelling and immersion, even if the fights aren't that hard. Most of the combat-focused encounters we get feel like fairly standard fantasy stuff. There's a goblin mine outside the first village, which also has an ogre in it if you choose to investigate. Likewise, there's a giant's dwelling beyond the second village, and you can turn up and ruin his day as well if you like. There's a troll with a halberd and a couple of bandits. On top of the mini-mite Jan, there's some whimsical elvins who want to nick things and play small practical jokes. That's something of an 80s fantasy classic. There's also some headhunters who will try to kill and eat you in a small action set piece that has aged very poorly in conception, and even more poorly when you see the art that accompanies the text. There's more or less nothing here that couldn't have come out of any one of a dozen fighting fantasy game books, and it contributes to the Shamatanti Hills feeling a bit anemic compared to some of the more well-developed locations in the series. It's certainly no Forest of Doom or Island of the Lizard King. This is also not the most tightly constructed game book ever. There's a few places where I found myself scratching my head at the choices I'd been presented with. You heard in the playthrough how I dug a cesspit in order to make some money to spend at the trader, but then didn't actually get the chance to go back to spend my well-gotten gains. There's also a trader where you can look at only 3 items from his selection, which makes zero sense. It's very clear that Jan the Mini-Mite is a massive pain in the backside, whose anti-magic aura is a real problem, but there's no option just to lightly stab him in his tiny face to deal with the issue. You also have no option other than answering the hunchback's riddles or leaving him alone, which again feels like there's something missing. This is to say nothing of the host of small continuity errors throughout the gamebook, often relating to spell components. None of these issues break the game, but it's all too common to feel like you're being hustled from one encounter to the next with indecent haste, or to feel like the book has strong ideas about how you should approach things that might not accord with your natural instincts in the situation. There's a lot of things in here that could have benefited from a little bit more depth. The structure is very linear. You get the opportunity to take different routes between the villages, but for a wilderness story, the overall path is very direct. There's stuff to do in the villages, but I found myself wanting more, especially early doors. I think that's partly just my own preferences. I really like bumbling around villages and towns, getting into trouble with the locals, and I feel sad when I'm not given the proper opportunity to do that. There is some fun stuff in here, no doubt. I like the Crystal Waterfall tourist attraction and the madcap childhood festival that's ongoing in Biratanti. And who doesn't love the opportunity to stay up all night digging a cesspit? But a lot of the locations are so broadly sketched that it all feels a bit cursory, even though the book is 456 sections long. You get the same feeling from the spaces between the villages as well. There's nothing in there that feels particularly developed. And because the book is fairly easy, there's an argument for saying that the best thing to do is to ignore most of the tantalising hints being presented to you. Fortunately, there is a meta reason to pay attention to that stuff off the main plot, and that leads me on to the best thing about this book, the magic system. A lot of those 456 sections are being taken up by the magic system. Whenever there's the opportunity to cast a spell, you get presented with five different options, of which some are real spells and some are red herrings the author has thrown in to confuse you. If you try to cast a spell that doesn't exist, or cast a spell where you don't have components, you'll end up taking a stamina penalty and nothing will happen. Get it right though, and there's every chance that you'll have bypassed the challenge at a single stroke. And I think this system is great on many levels. The core mechanic, where you have to remember what spell all the three-letter codes refer to and what components they might involve, that is fabulous. There's a real pleasure in getting better at remembering all the different options, and picking the exact right spell to deal with your current situation feels amazing every time for me. Especially when you pick one of the more obscure spells that has a lower stamina cost associated with it. I don't know quite why the magic rules are optional, because it's wonderful, and having to balance the book so that it's possible to just punch your way to victory as well necessarily limits the impact that magic can have, which is a real shame. I think if you're going to make a magic system this good, have the courage of your convictions and make it critical to beating the book. The only major issue with the magic system, and it's a big one, is that whenever you invoke the chance to cast spells, you're adding a minimum of five sections to the encounter. There's more than 30 opportunities to cast spells in this adventure. On the one hand, that's awesome. If you're going to demand that the player memorise a bunch of spells, then it's entirely right to give them plenty of opportunities to make use of that knowledge. On the other hand, that is more than 150 sections you've spent just on getting people to choose spells from a list. Even in a longer book like this, you've taken out a big chunk of the available space, about a third by my very rough calculations. That's probably why other elements of the book end up feeling a bit superficial and the adventure feels quite short as a result. It highlights how even the most interesting systems, and I do think this is a really interesting system, come at a cost. I think I might have been inclined to reduce the number of options at certain points when the stakes were lower. I think doing five choices each and every time is excessive. I'd prefer to try and use the wider range of options for situations where the player is under more stress to reflect it's more difficult to bring the perfect spell to mind when there's a monster trying to set fire to your face or whatever. The other small issue with the magic system is that if you roll the best character with a skill of 10, using magic to deal with monsters can feel a bit superfluous. Because it's balanced around a lower than usual skill level, The monsters, apart from the manticore at the end, are generally less physically threatening than average. If you've got a skill of 10, there's plenty of times where you can probably just punch your way through the fight, losing less stamina than you would spend on the spell to get past without fighting. And that's kind of an old problem with the fighting fantasy system, so I'm not going to belabor it, but once again, balance rears its ugly head. This book would really have benefited from deterministic character generation. I also think that it would have been good to generally present the spell options before you get the chance to find out what skill and stamina the monster actually has. That, I think, would have added a nice bit of jeopardy. Still, the magic system remains an absolute highlight, even when you summon multiple magical giants to deal with monsters and the wretched things seeming capable of dealing even a single point of damage to the foe, so you then have to fight the monster anyway, except that you've now spent stamina and spell reagents for the privilege of doing so. The important thing is that I'm not bitter in the slightest. One cool side effect is that the magic system gives you a little impetus to explore thoroughly in search of reagents for your spells. We already saw that there was an opportunity to bother some bees and grab their honey and beeswax. Honey is nice to eat, but that beeswax is a handy component for a spell that makes your sword extra sharp. Even played in isolation, there's a definite pleasure to be had from finding more components so you can fill in more of your spellbook. It scratches that collectible itch that makes things like Pokemon so appealing. Of course, this book isn't taking place in isolation. There's an added reason to explore thoroughly. You have to assume that the journey is only going to get more dangerous, and therefore spells will become increasingly important. It's therefore in your best interest to try and get as many components as possible to give yourself access to the widest possible range of spells. As if to remind you of that fact, there's a couple of points in the book where you can do things that will have an impact on the second book, Carré, Cityport of Traps. If you take the opportunity to allow the assassin to live, there's a good chance you'll be able to meet up with him later. There's also a key on offer which might help you if you get sent to prison in Carré. These all do a nice job of foreshadowing your further adventures and encourage you to take the opportunity to grab as much gear as possible while things are still fairly chill. One weird element of this book is the way the provision system and sleep works. While I definitely appreciate any effort to make food behave more like food than sausage roll-shaped first aid kits, the approach taken here yields mixed results. It's good to get a sense of the passage of time, which dividing the adventure into discrete days does a good job of delivering. But given that provisions can be a little hard to come by, and any adventurer worth their salt would much rather spend their money on swords and magical bombs than food, you do end up in the slightly ridiculous situation of only eating when it's absolutely necessary, which is usually last thing at night. It's a bit weird to see an adventurer turn down food on the basis that it makes more sense to eat a single sandwich at midnight than it does to tuck into a hearty plate of stew in the middle of the day. It's a minor thing, but it does consistently come across as a bit odd. I do like that you reliably get a handful of stamina back each day from eating and getting a good night's sleep. That does feel quite realistic, and I think you can probably overcome the issues by creating a distinction between low and high quality meals, whereby you can always manage to scrounge up something to stave off hunger that doesn't cost, but you can choose to eat better fare and thereby regain a little stamina if you do so. It's a bit more faff, but I think kind of presenting a character who's aiming at least to eat 3 square meals a day would come across more like how humans actually relate to food. Overall, though, I did enjoy the Shamatanti Hills quite a lot. The magic system makes up for a lot of the missteps elsewhere, and the book is perfectly functional. It being relatively easy made it feel oddly relaxing, which is not something I experience with game books, generally speaking. I'm usually aware that I've only got a certain amount of time before my episode is due out, which tends to elevate the tension significantly if a book presents a serious challenge. Here, I felt like I was being given a break, which was a nice change of pace. It's refreshing after the generally very hard late fighting fantasy books to play something where there is actually multiple routes through the action. There's lots of moments in the book that I did enjoy, and it all hangs together perfectly nicely. It's not remarkable by any stretch of the imagination. it could easily come across a bit weak in isolation, but it's still a solidly good time that lays an intriguing foundation for future books in the series. I'll be fascinated to see what happens next time when we play Kare City Port of Traps, which I remember absolutely loving as a child. That is all for this episode. I do hope you'll join me in a few weeks when we'll be doing another bonus episode, though I'm not entirely sure what it'll be at this point. It's going to be some kind of surprise. There's also another episode of Popular Antiquarian out, where I'm looking at H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, as staged by the world's cheapest film studio. Check it out if you like that sort of thing. In the meantime, you can get in contact with me by email at hjdoomretrofun, all one word, at gmail.com, or by following me on Blue Sky at hjdoom. Thank you very much for listening. Take care, and I'll see you soon.